You are listening to the Experience Points Podcast, episode number 156, for the week of January 18th, 2012.
Welcome back to the Experience Points Podcast. My name is George Albor.
I'm Scott Juster.
And we are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a site dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games and culture and a bunch of other stuff.
Sometimes the nostalgic analysis of video games.
That's exactly right. And tonight we're taking a trip down sort of memory lane and talking about an article written by Lee Alexander over at Edge. And this is an opinion piece called Truly Great Games. And this article is really about how our own personal context, the place we are in our life, the experiences we're going through, maybe some rites of passage we might be experiencing, shape how we view games at a very fundamental level, right? In terms of how we memorize or remember the quality of the game, in terms of how we remember how important that game was, not just to ourselves, but within the greater canon. To some extent, it's an article about how we're all sort of biased by the places we are in our lives when we play those specific games.
Right. And, you know, she brings it up because she had been recently playing Ocarina of Time. She also was playing Skyward Sword. I mean, Zelda is one of the epicenters of emotional gaming for a lot of people.
Right. And I think that when we look at games critically, we try to be as, I guess you could say, it's weird because I feel like we try to be objective while also respecting the fact that objectivity is sort of a myth and
right.
You know, everything we say is a subjective response. But I think it's interesting to try to specifically keep in mind our personal context when looking at certain games, both now and in the past. So maybe we should structure this podcast by talking about some games that we think fit this model and sort of help explain the way the personal contexts affect how we relate to and view certain games. And then we'll talk a little bit about the article in general and the concept in general.
Okay. So should we open up our memory treasure chest here and see what...
We should. Do you want to start us off?
I'll start us off with a relatively recent one, actually. I'll start us off with just, what is it now? I guess it's 2 years ago now. Red Dead Redemption is kind of one of these games for me.
Really?
Right. And for strange reasons. So, I mean...
You were at the dude ranch. You were a cowboy,
basically. I was framed for a murder I didn't commit. Wait, no, that's not even the story of Red Dead Redemption. Red Dead Redemption is he is trying to get his wife and kid back from corrupt government agents.
Right.
But I think that also just goes to show of as how much I've just imprinted my own feelings onto that game. And a lot of it had to do with where I was at the time. Even in the fundamental aspects of where I was, like, I was living in a place that was very sunny and warm in the summer when I was playing that game. And I have this striking memory of whenever I think of Red Dead, I think of sweating myself as well. Like, I was thinking, like, wow, this feels like the desert out here. Because I'm sitting in the sunroom playing a game. The PS3's giving off a huge amount of heat. The TV's giving off a huge amount of heat. And there's just vultures circling around.
Were you in Los Angeles at the time?
No, I was up here in the supposedly temperate Bay Area.
Oh, so it was that, like, three-day period where it was really sunny and warm.
It was the one day in the Bay Area that was 85 degrees, and I thought I was going to die.
Interesting. I like the environmental context. I didn't actually think about that.
Yeah, and everything else that is wrapped up in Red Dead Redemption, I immersed myself in that game. Mm-hmm. You know, people talk about how all-encompassing the world was in that game, but it was also down to, like, personal context, another personal context, which is I had at that point in time, I had, like, a few free weekends where all I did was play that game. Mm-hmm. And so the immersion was also me setting aside all day and all night to play that game. And I very rarely have the time anymore to just binge on games.
So I'm going to jump the gun a little bit.
Go.
But this is a subject I wanted to talk about. I think that when you're sitting down for a session and you're playing a long game, I think it both lends itself well to extra criticism because you're committed, right? You're experiencing the whole thing at once. You roll with the punches. and you get to look at all of the mistakes because you have to remember them as you're playing. But you also, I feel like you're still moving forward, so you sort of leave those things behind when you reach them and generally enjoy a game more. I think I might go on a limb here and say games are better when they're played in longer chunks of time. And I wonder if this is partially explains some of our fond feelings or strong memories with games that we played in high school when we didn't have full-time jobs, we didn't have, you know, wives or kids or, you know, whatever other time sink we currently have.
Yes, my wife, the time sink.
She the old ball that. And chain, yeah. Do you think that the amount of time that we invest in the sort of, I guess that sort of context affects how we appreciate a game years later?
Yeah, I mean, especially, you know, getting back to the whole Zelda example, I mean, most people, especially around our age group, cohort people, I mean, they experience these games, as Lee says in the article, over the holidays, where you generally don't have work or school, and you're able to just jump right into the game, maybe even play it a couple times, depending on how much time you have off. And when you're at that point in your life, something that is, you know, what she says, you know, it's a troublesome term calling something a truly great game, because at that time, a truly great game is something that can keep you occupied for that number of hours.
Right.
Whereas now a truly great game for us might be Angry Birds or something, because you could play it anywhere, anytime, and you can have a fulfilling experience on the train, you know?
And it is for a lot of people.
Right.
Right. Well, I'll talk a little bit about one game that stands out for me, at least. I don't have a great memory with some of the older games that I played, so when I think of a game that wasn't actually that good, it's kind of surprising for me. Mm-hmm. And this game, I actually don't remember what it was called, oddly enough.
Oh, man. Here we go.
So when I was a kid, especially when I was a very young kid, we weren't particularly well-off family, and my brother was not necessarily of the highest moral quality, and he stole a game from Best Buy with us one day.
But that's like, you know, what would that be on the D&D character? Like, he's unlawful good
chaotic,
or something?
He's chaotic good. He's right, chaotic there good. You go. Right. So he was basically trying to make a good day for his younger brother and sister who were having a rough time for whatever reason. And so he stole this game, and it was a Marvel superhero game. And it was a multiplayer game. Mm-hmm. And we probably didn't even play it all that often. But for me, it sticks out. Quite a bit, because, you know, as a kid growing up, especially growing up somewhat poor, you don't always get the opportunity to play get a new experience from a game, or even have a good experience sometimes when you're going through a rough batch at whatever age you happen to be going through. Right. So for me, it stands out as one of the most memorable gaming experiences I've ever had, even though it's not a particularly memorable play experience in and of itself. Right. Mm-hmm. Probably wasn't a great game. There's a lot of Marvel games that have been developed over the years and thrown out pretty quickly, but it's a memorable one regardless.
He did that store a favor by stealing it, because they weren't going to sell that thing.
Yeah, probably.
That's just a write-off for them.
And it's Best Buy. Who cares?
Yeah, I mean, that's... take that, Geek Squad. So where do we go from here? I feel like, you know, we've done the sentimental side of things, but, you know, we're trying to figure out, like, you know, a truly great game, and that you have these two competing things of, like, okay, this is like the emotional time and place context of playing the game, but there's also like what many reviews aspire to do, which is set aside a little bit of the emotional side and take a look at the design side, or take a look at the larger aesthetic qualities of the game. And I think that's where we kind of come back to examining some of what are considered to be like the canonical great games out there.
Right.
As Lee was doing in this article. I mean, she wrote that people don't talk about Ocarina in terms of graphics or level design. They talk about it in terms of the context in which they remember playing. And I actually kind of want to push back on that a little bit.
Okay.
Mainly because I love Ocarina of Time. But I'm going to try to justify it in a... I think there is something still to be said for distinguishing sentimentality and whatever, a more dispassionate view of a great game.
Right.
You know, especially in the case of Ocarina, because not only was it a time and a place style game for people, it was a time and a place style game for the medium.
Right.
You know, Z targeting still works really well in Ocarina of Time, and many games subsequently have messed up Z targeting, even in this day and age.
Right.
So it's like there are certain, if not quantitative, qualitative arguments you can make that aren't just about, well, I remember Zelda because I played it through with my first girlfriend or something.
Right. And we should say, neither of us believe that Lee is suggesting the only way we can analyze games is through a subjective personal context lens.
Definitely not.
But even that case, couldn't you say that to some extent the context is the context of other games before and now?
Like, right, that's the thing, like, analyzing it in its historical timeline, basically.
I mean, just imagine, you know, we were joking about it a little bit before the podcast, but if someone raised by wolves, right, were to play yeah. play just one game, and it was Ocarina of Time,
mm-hmm.
how impactful would it be?
Right, right. Because they wouldn't know what a huge deal it was to see a three-dimensional Zelda, or to see a Zelda with a horse, you right. know? Well, I mean, so much of that game is about a shift in expectations as to what a right. Zelda game would be.
Well, and also to know that some of those things weren't carried forward, right? Mm. Like, when we played, God, I'm having a brain lapse right now, the Squaresoft RPG time travel...
Chrono Trigger.
When we played Chrono Trigger, and finally we get to talk about it again on the show, yay!
Yeah, it's been a long time.
One of the things we discussed was that Chrono Trigger does some things that RPGs haven't done since, or at least that I've seen commonplace in the RPGs that I've played.
Right.
And if you were to play Chrono Trigger and loved it, but didn't play any other RPGs that came afterwards, you might think, well, this is going to be the example for future games, and so future games will maybe iterate on it and make it better than even Chrono Trigger manages to accomplish, mm-hmm. which is just not really the case. Chrono yeah. Trigger is still one of the best RPGs you could play, period.
Mm-hmm.
But if you didn't know that going in, it might not be as impactful as we think.
Right. So, I mean, maybe we're talking about, and, you know, this is like a magical land where everyone has an unlimited amount of resources and free time, but, you know, the real trick to sussing out which games are the truly great ones is, one, to consider the personal emotional attachment to them, mm-hmm. but two, to revisit games every once in a while.
Right.
And see what happened to them. Like Chrono Trigger, let me scare everyone here. Chrono Trigger came out over 15 years ago now. Oh, man, we are old.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, what other game does time traveling? Very few games do time traveling, period.
Right.
And what other game does time traveling in a more elegant way?
Right. Or lets you befriend the boss.
Right.
I mean, there's many things we can point out that are just not, you know, oft repeated since Chrono Trigger, and
leaving
for that
main character's dead, like,
right,
you know, and
for that reason, I think you're exactly right. It's revisiting it and finding, if not the same level of appreciation, another thing to appreciate from that game that still exists. Because it doesn't have to be that no one else has copied it, but maybe you're getting something else out of it in this now personal context, right?
Right.
Because there are times when I played a game as a kid that maybe resonated with me because I was a kid and I was going through kid stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Lee Alexander mentions in the article, Zelda is about a boy becoming a man. And
yeah.
for some people, playing Zelda in that same time period, when they too are going through significant changes in their life and becoming more mature, it means a lot to them. But revisiting the game now, for example, and if you were to get something out of it, not as a person coming of age, but maybe as a father or as a mother or as a, you know, as a person who thinks X about whatever,
yeah,
then
yeah.
that's still a great experience that is adapting itself to some extent to the personal context that you find yourself in.
And it's so hard to figure out then where, if we're looking for the mythical, truly great game, how much of that the actual game dynamics have to do, and how much the, even on a more basic level, and how much the actual mechanics have to do with all that. You know,
right.
does Z-targeting really make Zelda the best game ever, or does the sense of exploration and the mystery make it the best game? Or does the fact that you know, like you were saying, you played it as you were kind of growing up alongside Link make it the best game?
Right.
It's a hard thing to parse. But I don't know, I was thinking of a couple of examples of games that I've revisited and had different responses to.
All right.
One of them is, I thought it was like one of the truly great games when I first played it. And then I played it again, and I thought it was one of the truly great games, but because of a different reason. And that is Metal Gear Solid 2. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first time I thought it was one of the truly great games because I was thinking of it in a, you know, more dispassionate sense. I was like, oh, yeah, look at all of those bottles you can break with every single bullet, or, you know, the first-person stealth mechanics are second to none, and, you know, on a very almost mechanical level, you know?
Right.
And then I replayed it a while back, and I realized, one, how brave it was to tease the entire world with Solid Snake and then be like, nope, you're going to play as Raiden for 90% of the game.
Yeah.
That is wild. Like, who else besides Kojima does that? Like, just such a... just pulling out the rug from under everyone who's playing it.
Right.
And then secondly, that game gets weird at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. Do you remember any of Metal Gear Solid 2?
I never finished it.
Oh, man. I don't blame you for not finishing it, because it gets, like, tedious from a gameplay perspective. But right. At the end, they start talking about how there is a set of basically, well, one, supercomputers and shadow government that are basically spreading ideas throughout the world. And they even use terms like memes and stuff like that.
Right.
And this was in 2001. And so they're talking about, like, digitally incorporating everything into computers so you can't tell the difference between where the digital world starts and where a meme starts and where it ends and what is the source of an idea. And, like, looking back on that now, 10 years on, it's so far ahead of its time. Like, right. You can make something right now that dealt with those issues and it'd be considered, oh, wow, this is contemporary issues.
Well,
and,
like, what about 10 years from now? Like, do you think you'll replay this game again and go, oh, well, yeah, that was interesting in its time, but, you know, what's interesting about Metal Gear Solid 2 now, as you're suggesting, is that even playing it today, you could still get something out of it in terms of its sort of narrative at the end and that crazy amount of politics and all that stuff.
Right.
But 10 years from now, who knows?
Yeah, and it wouldn't have that impact because I've already kind of, you know, matured as a human being and come to grips with how strange the world is and stuff. You know, it wouldn't have that shocking revelation.
Right. I mean, I think that the really great games, it's hard because you want to say that the great games stand on their own, even outside of the context that you find themselves, mm-hmm. the context, at least the historical context that you find yourself in. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily the case. A game could be great within its embedded context mm-hmm. in retrospect.
And I think some are more apt to lend themselves to that description than others. Like, this review hasn't gone up yet. Chris, if you're listening, I swear this will be in soon. I've been playing Sonic CD recently.
Oh, yes.
And I don't really know much about the Sonic franchise as a whole. Like, I'm not as knowledgeable about Sonic as I am about some of the other famous video game franchises. But I am under the impression that Sonic CD is one of the more beloved Sonic games out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm having this strange experience because I never experienced it contemporaneously. Like, I didn't play it when it was out.
Right.
And so I'm coming to this Sonic game, one, very, very far after its release date, and two, as someone that isn't necessarily as invested in the Sonic lore as everyone else is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm having a hard time figuring out, well, basically, why people love this game so much.
So you never played this when you were a kid?
I never played Sonic CD was one of the more obscure ones too, since it was like part of the Sega CD and like then they ported it to another Sega system. There's like a weird history behind it, but I never played many of the Sonic games anyway.
Have you thought about asking someone?
I've been cautiously reaching out to a couple people. But like as for review purposes, I kind of just wanted to maintain that perspective as someone reviewing it in the year 2012, reviewing this game that is kind of has a bit of a legacy about it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm missing out, you know, like this review of one of these like great games, supposedly great games, is a little strange because I don't have, like Lee was saying, I don't have the time and the place to properly assess it.
I see.
I'm coming from a strangely outsider's perspective.
Yeah, you can't take the sort of ethnography approach, I suppose, right?
Right.
You can't, you're not embedded in that context, in that place and time, to enjoy it the way that others did in that place and time when it was first released.
All I see is the blind corners and the spikes that you can't see until you get hit by them. And it kind of irritates me. And I'm like, yeah. Well, I wonder if this was very irritating to people at the time, or if this is something that now, with our modern view and hindsight, you know, being 2020, we can see, oh, well, actually, this game was kind of weird, you know?
I think it's partially about what we forgive in that space and time, because I have no doubt that people were frustrated. It's not like, you know, when that game first came out, people had preternatural skills of dodging spikes.
Yeah.
Right? It's just that meant less. And part of that is expectations. Part of that is familiarity with the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all of those, I guess, are contextual in some way.
Mm-hmm. There's a game that you've been playing recently that I wanted to ask you about in terms of this, because a lot of people are calling it one of the best games of the year, like a great game. And this is Dark Souls.
Yes.
So I wonder, since I haven't played it, well, first, this is like a mini soapbox for you. Like, how are you liking it? And two, how much of the Dark Souls experience do you think is this communal playing of Dark Souls, and how much of it is this more design philosophy? Like, is the level design really that genius, or is this more of an emotionally driven experience?
You know, I think the level design is genius for what it's trying to do.
Which has hurt you at every turn.
Exactly. But at the same time, there are periods where when you're facing this impossible challenge, it's really disheartening. And it's really, punishing is, I think, the wrong word, but you feel nervous and bad approaching it, and you're not sure if you can do it. But when you actually do it and you think about it in retrospect, you realize the sort of the pathway that you took there is so heavily designed, right? You went forward, then you fell back. You went forward and fell back, going farther a little bit each time, learning it. It makes the process of learning and conquering, no matter how difficult it is, clear and open to you once you've finished, right? Mm-hmm. You got here, and you know exactly how you got here. And that's ingenious level design, right? That's really clever, a really clever construction of the game. At the same time, personally speaking, I have more of a respect for this game than an appreciation of the game as a player.
Right.
I don't think that it's entirely designed for me in my personal context, if you will. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm just not as patient of a person as I need to be right now in my life, or maybe I don't have the type of time that I need to invest into this play experience to get out of it what I think a lot of other people are getting out of it. But I think for a lot of people who are in that right space and time, everything works together really well, both the level design and the communal aspect.
And I think that's why a lot of reviewers try to approach their reviews as neutral, because trying to incorporate everyone else's potential personal emotional bonds is really hard, and trying to communicate your personal emotional bonds to a game is also really hard. So it's actually, to me, it's when I write a very dispassionate review, it's almost the path of least resistance.
Right.
Because it's really hard to describe to someone the weird tingling sensation I get on the back of my neck when I find a hidden cave in Zelda.
Right.
You know, like, it doesn't play very well in print, you know?
Well, like, I mean, you know, a weird example is I recently wrote a review for the latest Professor Layton game.
Uh-huh.
And I love Professor Layton, and I think that the series is fantastic and incredibly atmospheric and does not get enough respect for its atmosphere and the tone and the sort of frivolity, enjoyable frivolity that the game creates. Mm-hmm. And so I hit a puzzle in the review of a puzzle game as my sort of way to both write a normal review but also respect my own biases towards that, right, and sort of mirror my thoughts on that game. I don't know if it worked. But
I'm glad you say that, because I didn't know if you were just messing with me or not. I read that thing and I was like, is there really a puzzle in here? And then I stopped searching for it because I thought maybe you were just messing with me.
Oh, no, it's there.
There's a puzzle in there.
Yep.
Oh, man, that's going to eat at me now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a simple one. It'll take you like five minutes.
That's going to eat at me more, since I didn't, you know, I read the thing and I didn't see it right away.
I guess the point being is, when we're trying to think about what's a great game, even when we're thinking about it, it helps to be in that context, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it helps to remind yourself, I'm in this here and now, and I'm not just appreciating the game because I appreciate the way that it's built, but I'm appreciating it because I'm in my current position, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess that sort of brings me to one last question, which is, What sort of biases do you think that we have now, either as individuals or within a society as a whole, because of the context that we find ourselves in, be it where we're American or you and I have our own personal context, or, you know, it's the year 2012 and there's a Mayan prophecy that the world will end or whatever. Yep. There's all sorts of contexts that we can find ourselves in. How do game designers or people thinking ahead about games that aren't even out yet, do we prepare ourselves for the type of biases that we might meet?
Right. I feel like there's a couple ways you can approach it. I mean, one is, and we've discussed this before, I feel like as our cohort ages, our games age along with us.
Mm-hmm.
So you get everything from a simple yet emotionally moving game like Passage, which is talking about a little bit more sophisticated things than the old arcade games would be talking about, even though it's rendered in a similar visual style. And you get something like I would consider this one of our favorite games of the past year, Mortal Kombat,
mm-hmm.
where I feel like personally anyway, you're probably similar to I am in this respect. Like our attachment to Mortal Kombat was largely a nostalgic, emotional one.
Absolutely.
But this most recent Mortal Kombat modernized the series in a mechanical way. Like for the first time in a really long time, Mortal Kombat is considered a pretty legit fighting game. Like it shows up at Evo and other tournaments and stuff, right. Which was just simply not the case in the past. So as we've aged and as the series has aged alongside of us, it's now okay to start incorporating more of the dispassionate elements now that we've already have the emotional bond set up for us. You know, right. we know how much we like the idea of remembering MK, but now the actual feel of the game kind of matches that nostalgia.
Yeah. You know, I'm also, I mean, it's sort of tangential, but I'm really interested to see what shooters will be like over the coming years as we sort of wind down America's involvement in a lot of foreign wars.
Right.
I mean, I know we still have a huge presence internationally, but I think there's something to say for the type of games that came out in the 2001 to present time period, right. In which the fears of terrorism were manifested in the types of games that we played. And we, even now, you know, there are some games that actually address some of the criticisms of the war on terror and all those mm-hmm. sorts of political issues. But, you know, maybe 10 years from now, who knows what type of experiences we will feel more connected to because of the new context, right?
Right. And there's always that few years lag, you know, like
right.
Iraq was 2003, and now games that get started in 2003 are built in this society where like shock and awe is a buzzword. So, and then lo and behold, now a few years after that, shooters are all about shock and awe from a visual perspective, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Personally speaking, I've always been a fan of like father-child stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I think The Last of Us is a game that I'm going to automatically be a little bit biased towards because
right.
I just have an appreciation for that type of story.
Right. I agree. There's definitely like as people, it's good to see that there are certain changes, even though it's all a similar, like, you know, playing on emotions, and it is going to always be contextual, that it's not always the Zelda story.
Yeah.
Which makes the Zelda story even weirder. Like, I'm playing Skyward Sword right now, and it is literally the Zelda story. Like, it's a young boy who didn't think he's going to be a hero, and now he's a hero. And you know, it's just, it is the same thing, but the rest of the industry seems to be moving a little bit in a more diverse direction.
Right. And it can't help but not, you know?
Right. Or else you end up with a game like Skyward Sword, which is that's a whole nother podcast topic, everybody.
Right, right.
I actually kind of like it, but whatever.
Oh, okay. Well, good. You had the review. That was just, I felt like you were stirring up a hornet's nest.
Oh, yeah. You can do that in the game, too, but you can catch them with a net. I'm catching all these hornets with a net before I can get too stung by it.
Which brings you back to your childhood memory of catching hornets with a net.
Yeah, I still got those scars.
Yep.
All right. Well, shall we open up the floor for people to weigh in with their emotional attachments?
Absolutely.
All right. If you want to talk about the truly great games, whatever that may mean, experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And of course, I'm curious to know what sort of contexts you might find interesting today. What types of games that you think will automatically grab your attention because of the place that you happen to be in, or places you've been in the past that fundamentally shape, you know, who you are and how you approach games. You can leave all of your thoughts at experiencepoints.net as well. We update that site Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday evenings. We also, of course, write on Pop Matters, so go over there and check out all the great writing you could find on that site.
All right, until next time, everyone. Thanks for listening. Take it easy.
Bye-bye. Every time we disagree, there's a place to go to.